My Classic Album with Mike Norris is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of My Classic Album and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.
It's just like a wall of awesomeness coming at you. That's how I would describe the whole album.
It's just been a lot of fun for me, Mike, to talk with you about this album at this moment.
It's something that everybody should hear at least once in their life.
It's fucking amazing!
You're listening to My Classic Album with Mike Norris.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of My Classic Album. As always, looking back on some of the greatest albums in music history, I'm Mike Norris. Thank you to anyone who has been joining us throughout the summer. We've had some fantastic episodes with some amazing guests, and the train keeps rolling for our last two episodes of season three. So, you know, I'd split this up. We came back in October of 2020, been pumping out the episodes for close to a year now, and I think it's time to have a little bit of a break, put the brakes on. But there's two great episodes between now and then. One of them, of course, is today. Singer-songwriter Reva Taylor is joining me to chat about the fantastic debut album from Annie Lennox, Diva. Annie Lennox, as I'm sure you'll hear kind of in our conversation, one of my favourite voices in music, certainly my favourite female singer of all time. I think she's absolutely phenomenal. Love her stuff with Eurythmics, but there's something about her solo career that's just really special to me. So when Reva chose Diva as her classic album, I was very excited to dive into it. And I know there's been a few people on the social media pages who've been quite excited about us doing this album on the podcast today. For example, Martin Stone Hennessy said on our Facebook page, "I'm so excited to hear your thoughts on Diva, one of the most perfectly balanced albums ever, in my opinion. Amazing to think it came out 30 years ago next year. That and Faith No More's Angel Dust were the soundtrack of the summer of 1992 for me, and I still have my original CD copies of both." And you know what it is? Again, looking back to the 90s, this is very much when, you know, I was in 1992, I was like infant school, to be perfectly honest, you know, very young age. But again, this is where, you know, that awareness of some of this stuff. I remember hearing Annie Lennox on the radio. I remember hearing Nirvana on the radio. We'll talk about Nirvana in a moment. You know, absolutely, the 90s albums that we do and beyond that is where I start to have some memories of what was going on at the time when these albums were released. Whereas as much as I love my music from the 80s and the 70s, I either wasn't born or was very, very young indeed. So when we do a 90s album or a 2000s album, as we've sometimes done, it's a lot of fun for me to think back about my memories of the album. And that's, I think it's going to be great for you to hear my chat with Reva all about this fantastic album. And that's coming up in just a little bit. I did mention Nirvana there. That's because the last episode of season three, which is going to be coming out on the 24th of September, we'll be looking back at one of the giants of classic albums. 30 years ago, on the 24th of September, was the release of Nirvana's Nevermind album. And we're going to be celebrating that with one of our special anniversary episodes. Again, I do have a vague awareness, even though I was very young at the time, I've got a vague awareness of Nirvana being around, being on the radio. It wasn't until I got a little bit older and I was introduced to the band by my good friend Nathan Stevens Griffin, who many of you may know from bands such as Martha, One Night Stand in North Dakota, and more. Nathan joined us way back in episode 6 to talk about The Smiths, The Queen Is Dead, one of my favourite episodes, certainly, of that first season. Nathan's agreed to come back, and we're going to have a great chat all about Nevermind. Not just how it's affected both of us, but again, a bit about our friendship as well, because I remember Nathan introducing me to Nirvana very vividly, and, you know, that was very much a part of my musical journey growing up that Nathan did that. He also introduced me to the Beatles as well, as it happens. So it'll be quite a fun chat to have with Nathan to get stuck into all of that. And that's coming out on the 24th of September. Now, if you want to be involved in that episode, it's not too late. If you've listened to our anniversary episodes before, if you haven't, feel free to head back, because we celebrated 40 years of Rumours, 30 years of Hysteria by Def Leppard, and 40 years of Battered Hell by Meatloaf, all in 2017. And then last year, we celebrated 45 years of A Night at the Opera with Savannah Pope. So we've got form for this before. We've done these. It's, you know, it's great. And as much research, as much as I love doing the normal episodes, the anniversary ones are a lot of fun because I get people a bit more involved than maybe I normally would. So one of the things that we're doing this time, which is a new thing I've never tried before, but it's going to be a lot of fun, is that I've been kind of calling on some of the people who present some of my favorite music podcasts to get their thoughts on Nevermind. So we're talking podcasts such as Concerts That Made Us, The Rock Guys Podcast, A Sound Purchase, really, really fantastic music podcasts. If you've not heard them before, they're in all the usual places, just like we are. So absolutely check them out. Some great music podcasts, and they've got some great opinions on this fantastic album. So you'll get to hear the opinions of those very esteemed podcast hosts on our episode in just a couple of weeks' time. But we're also going to do, as always, a bit of a vote on the social media channels for your favorite track from Nevermind. I have a suspicion I know which one that's going to be. Having said that, however, sometimes I'm proved wrong with that kind of thing. But also what we're going to do is I want to hear your thoughts. I want to hear your thoughts on this amazing album. So get yourself onto the social media channels. I've been posting a couple of times getting people to do that. Some people would rather message privately, which is absolutely fine. So get yourself to Facebook, My Classic Album Podcast. Send me your thoughts, be it on any post or indeed sending me a message. Follow us on Instagram, My Classic Album Podcast. Again, no problem with doing that at all. Get in touch, send us a message. Twitter, at @MCA_podcast. All of this information can be found at myclassicalbum.co.uk, but there's also a link there to send me an email, and I get those emails personally. I respond to them personally. So again, if you'd rather just send me an email with your thoughts, absolutely. And I'm going to read as many of them as I can on the show next time, just getting people's thoughts on Nevermind and on Nirvana. It is such an important album, and I'm really excited that we're covering it. Again, a slightly different slant for me in terms of the album as well. And some interesting stuff that's been happening in the build-up to it as well, of course, as kind of the 30th anniversary has come. And the album has been in the news quite a bit recently for reasons that you might not have expected. So some really interesting conversation that we had with Nathan, which of course is always going to be the main event of our 30 years of Nevermind podcast. But lots of other cool stuff going on as well. And hopefully we can get season 3 off with a bang and then, you know, take a little bit of a break and come back in the new year for season 4. But before we get into all that, let's get into today's episode. We've got a fantastic guest and an amazing album. You know, Reva Taylor has chosen Annie Lennox's phenomenal album Diva to talk about on My Classic Album today. I've got no bumblefucked hot sauce, so I'll probably get through this link quite well. And if no one knows what I mean, listen back to the previous episode with Ron Thal, because trying to do these links while ingesting hot sauce is not the easiest thing to do. It's much easier when I can just do it like this. So my special guest is Reva Taylor, and she has chosen Annie Lennox's Diva as her classic album. But before we get to my chat with Reva and all things Annie Lennox, let's just have a look at the facts. Here's the beginning of what you need to know about Diva. Diva is the debut solo album from Scottish singer-songwriter Annie Lennox. The album was released on the 6th of April 1992, following a quiet dissolution of Annie's partnership with Dave Stewart in Eurythmics. After a short break from the music industry, Annie teamed up with producer Stephen Lipson on what would become the beginning of her solo career. After an acclaimed run in Eurythmics throughout the 1980s, anticipation was high for Annie's solo steps. First single, Why, reached number 5 on the UK singles chart and made it number 4 on the US Billboard Hot 100. While Precious only charted number 23 in the UK, it was Walking on Broken Glass that proved Diva's next success, charting across the world, including number 1 in Canada, number 8 in the UK, and number 14 in the US. Follow-up singles Cold and Little Bird also saw chart success. The single's success was matched by the album itself. Diva reached the top of the UK albums chart and number 23 on the US Billboard 200. Diva also saw top 10 success in Australia, Canada and Germany, among others. It has also been certified 2 times platinum in the US and 4 times platinum back home in the UK. Diva solidified Annie Lennox as one of the most popular artists in the world, and the album has continued to grow in esteem. Rolling Stone named it amongst its essential recordings of the 90s in 1999, while The Scotsman placed it 57th in the 100 best Scottish albums of all time in 2003. So that's just the beginning of everything that we need to know about Diva, and I have here with me my special guest who chose Diva to talk about today on My Classic Album. This is Reva Taylor. How's it going?
Hi there. All very well here, thank you. Thanks very much for having me.
No worries at all. So obviously we just started to touch on this before I pressed record. Why have you chosen Diva to chat about on My Classic Album today?
Oh, goodness. So many reasons, really. I am an artist that is all about the album, and for me, there are a few that stand out in my youth that I, you know, that were always playing around the house. This was one of them. I'm a huge fan of Annie Lennox. I would use her as one of a very big influence on me and my writing. And just that with her, I think she's an incredible woman. And, you know, she continues to do amazing things both in the music industry and for women these days. And yeah, just the songs speak for themselves here, really. I think this was a debut album and something that I hadn't actually been aware of until I dug back into this. And thank you for creating this podcast, because it's you know, encouraged me to go back and listen to some of my favourite music, and this being one of them. But I hadn't been aware that she wrote the majority of these songs all by herself. There were only just a couple that she collaborated with other writers on. And this moment in time, that's a huge inspiration for me, because I'm digging into my own body of work right now and doing a lot of writing myself, which is actually the first time that I've really done that. This has been a little wake-up call, actually, that she did this and she created all of this pretty much on her own, so...
You'd said, obviously, that Annie Lennox has been a huge influence for you, both musically and perhaps sort of culturally as well, almost. What are your memories of hearing these songs for the first time?
Oh, wow. Well, it was Why that I remember, both Why and obviously No More I Love Yous, which is not featured on this album. They were some of my dad's favourite songs. And, you know, he loved Kate Bush, another influence of mine. I hold my dad to great esteem, because I do believe that he keyed my ears into all sorts of great artists growing up. And yeah, my memory is actually hearing Why in my front room. I think it was coming out of the television, so perhaps it was being performed or I don't know, it was on a music channel. But yeah, and just singing it and yeah, that's my main memory. And actually it's interesting, because the songs like Little Bird have sort of come back to me throughout the years. While it was probably Why and Walking on Broken Glass that, you know, were her lead singles off this album. Little Bird is a song that, I mean, I've had on a playlist since I think Spotify began, so whenever that was, 10 years, 15 years ago. They're just songs that I've carried with me through life. So yeah, it's an interesting one, and that really just does, you know, show a timeless album is a brilliant one.
And I mean, personally, I'm thrilled we're getting the opportunity to kind of celebrate Annie Lennox here on My Classic Album. And we do all sorts, but it tends to very much be in that kind of rock and metal kind of arena, and it's nice to do an Annie Lennox album. I mean, she was a huge influence on the music that I enjoy and listen to. I'd say she's one of, if not, I'd probably go as far to say she probably is my favourite female singer of all time. And I'd say that's been from the moment I heard her voice for the first time, which I think for me, you talked about No More I Love Yous. I think that was probably my first exposure to her as well. What do you think it is about Annie Lennox and that voice that's made her such an iconic presence in music for so long?
It is that voice, isn't it? You know, you just can't mistake it. It's genreless, actually. I was interested to see on Apple Music that it's rock. Do we describe this as rock? I've never been able to box Annie Lennox, thankfully, because I hate boxing artists, and I think the music industry does it far too much and far too readily. And I think it is the voice that tells the stories here. I think this is, sorry, I'm do sound very opinionated about modern music. I like a lot of modern music, but all too often I think it is songs these days are being led by the beat, or being led by TikTok, or being led by, you know, some other influence outside of the voice. And with Annie Lennox, it just cuts through and it tells the story. I love voices. You know, I'm a vocalist and I'm fascinated by people's voices and what they do with them. And hers is a voice that, you know, along with the Aretha Franklins and the Whitney Houstons, also different, but all that they all do their own amazing thing. And Annie Lennox obviously has such soul and such honesty. I hope she doesn't mind me saying this, but imperfection at times, which is so real and, as I say, honest, that it makes you want to listen more.
Now, you know, it's Annie's debut solo album. And for many listening today, their first exposure to that unmistakable voice will most likely have been when she was one half of Eurythmics with Dave Stewart. So I'm sure we'll talk plenty about that transition from being part of a duo into a solo star. What are your thoughts on her body of work with Eurythmics, and what was so special about them that meant that a solo album like Diva was so highly anticipated?
Oh, yes. That's an interesting one. I mean, I am also obviously a fan of Eurythmics. I'm looking up at a vinyl on my wall of the Eurythmics. And again, it is that voice that sort of cut through there. I really like the transition that she's made into this album from that world. It's far more... I need to choose my words carefully, because it's obviously what they had done together was completely groundbreaking. But this actually, I think, does make a stark transition. And I think it's a shift away from a slightly more synthetic world into more of a blend, I think, of synthetic and organic sounds. I think it's a slightly like more real sound, and again, it's probably pays testament to her writing this on her, you know, by herself. So for me, obviously, I've listened to both, and you know, you can't beat Sweet Dreams when you're in the right mood. But for me, I think this solo work actually does trump Eurythmics for me across the board.
And I think the reason, you know, again, obviously, I think what people realise as this conversation goes on is that we're talking about how, in some ways, their solo work has, in some ways, maybe eclipsed what she did with Eurythmics. Mm-hmm. But I think it's important to highlight just how successful they were, perhaps for people that maybe weren't aware. So Pop Matters said the following about them in 2017. So they were making a case for Eurythmics to be enshrined in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So, Pop Matters said, from In the Garden through to Peace, Eurythmics have presented an eclectic and consistently fascinating body of work that accomplishes what they set out to do, experiment and expand the possibilities of pop music. Their catalogue is fearless, unconventional, emotionally stirring and exquisitely crafted. Stewart and Lennox are both gifted songwriters, producers and musicians, and Lennox is a vocalist of stunning versatility and power. There's a theatricality to Eurythmics' work, a boldness that challenges listeners to leave behind their expectations and open their minds to endless possibility. So there's that really high praise. I think it's almost that sets the scene for what this album's going to be. It was a huge body of work to live up to, I guess.
Absolutely. And especially when you have defined, you know, your own sound, it's very difficult to move away from that, I would imagine, as a solo artist, something that you've created with somebody else. But as I say, I think she's managed to achieve that, which is incredible. But yeah, what a platform, what a start to your career. And I listen to the likes of London Grammar, and I think, oh, you know, obviously the Hannah, the vocalist there, is also a fantastic, you know, singer. She has her own sound, and I always wonder whether at what point maybe there is a, you know, she goes off in her own direction and creates something. I don't want to suggest it, because I'm sure they're very happy all together. But you know, artists are curious, and how that might sound. That's just a comparison I often make in the modern world. Other bands that are sort of, or collaborators who are creating works together, perhaps, you know, breaking off and doing their own thing and what happens there.
So after this phenomenal run of albums in the 80s, Annie and Dave disbanded in 1990. Not officially, by any stretch, but obviously they made that decision to go their own way. That dynamic of being bandmates and former lovers proven quite a difficult balance for them. Rob Gold, who was the former head of Virgin Music, said of the breakup, "The relationship became almost too much and got claustrophobic. Annie's head is in a completely different space now, and it's not like it was. She wants to move on." So without knowing the ins and outs of their relationship, and I guess, you know, I don't want to get too much into that because that's between them, but it must have been so hard for them to make that decision to walk away from this huge success that they'd had kind of throughout the 80s.
Oh my God, I can't even imagine. You know, incredibly difficult, and I wonder whether they, you know, they stayed in it longer than they should, perhaps, you know, because when you're that close to somebody, you know, artistically involved and also romantically, that can be very overwhelming. And of course, I have heard stories. I know people who've been in the same situation, and it's such a complex one to be in. But obviously, you know, together they created something for a reason, and that must have been because they were deeply connected. So pros and cons.
Yeah. I mean, Annie initially stepped away from the music industry, so it sounds like the Dave kind of instantly got more into that kind of collaborating with other people. Annie stepped away a little bit. She became a mother to her daughter Lola, who's now in the music business herself. During this time, she also battled with postnatal depression, as well as that adjustment to life outside of Eurythmics. I mean, how much of that do you think comes across on Diva? Not so much songs about postnatal depression, but more a recognition of kind of change and adjustment in a new phase in her life.
Oh, well, for sure. I mean, again, to go back to something like Little Bird, I think there's an element of flight and exploration, and in some of these lyrics here. Why? I mean, I've never heard Annie Lennox talk about what this is about, but there's a deep reflectiveness, I think, in a lot of her songs, but a sense of moving forward and exploration that I think is really lovely. So for sure, I mean, I have absolutely no doubt that this was, you know, written about that time and that movement away and looking forward into the future, which is, it was quite lovely.
And I've got a quote here, so that I've got a few quotes from a biography that was released a few years back, and it's got some kind of passages from Annie herself, and she'd said around that time, "Personally, I'm happier than ever I was, but I'm not naturally a happy person. I'm very dark. I have a tendency to see things in a rather negative way. Mm. Much as I enjoy beautiful things, I don't want to be surrounded by them the whole time because they cut me off from a different sort of reality. They lull you into thinking everything is safe, ordered and established, whereas in fact we're all hurtling towards whatever oblivion." And in a way, like, I think you'd said, and again, this was, I think, just as we'd started talking before we kind of got into this chat itself, that he said sometimes you listen to this album because you love it. Sometimes there is kind of I wouldn't call it a depressing album, but there's certainly kind of dark undercurrents that run through it at times.
Oh, 100%. Cold being one. I forgot how much I loved Cold as a song. Oh, it's the melody is something that just has always grabbed me. And I really think the bluesiness of this and her voice, and I've heard it come out in my writing. And I think this song has had more of an impact, while it wasn't one of her lead songs off this album, than I've known. Interesting, you know, even a song like Walking on Broken Glass, I love that that comes second. That sort of takes you out of that, the reflectiveness of why, into a more sort of up-tempo, what feels like uplifting song. But really, it's you know, the lyric is, to Addie's point, there's a darkness to it. And I think that's never too far away from the songs that even give you a sense of sort of euphoria. There's a seriousness about it. So, I think it's a complete blend, isn't it? And that's what probably, again, is so impactful in her writing.
So as Annie came through that depression, she started to feel more settled as a mum. That musical itch became more prominent. But it seems like, understandably, with kind of everything she'd been through, she'd lost a lot of confidence, and she's talked about that over the years. It was, in fact, an up-and-coming manager at the time named Simon Fuller, who obviously I'm sure many people will recognise that name, who would kickstart Annie's solo career.
Yeah, and isn't it interesting to hear? I mean, as artists, it's so refreshing to hear that, because, you know, we put Annie Lennox, rightly so, on a pedestal. She's incredible. But that someone as great as that has their insecurities and vulnerabilities, and then, you know, we have been in those positions where you write this stuff. Even now I'm writing, I'm like, oh, what point do I play it to people? Because the thing you don't want to hear is it wasn't as good as the last one you did or whatever. So it's incredibly exposing, that feeling. And you know, she'd obviously been at rock bottom expecting the worst. And it just shows, doesn't it? you always keep creating, always keep trying, and you never know if you're sitting with the right person at the right time, it can completely open your life up.
I mean, Simon, he would famously go on to form the Spice Girls just a few years later, who would dominate the world of pop throughout the 90s. Interestingly, he credited Annie as a big part of the success of the Spice Girls. And you were talking about, obviously, in some ways that Annie's genreless in some ways, but I couldn't think of two different acts in terms of sound from the Spice Girls and Annie Lennox. But do you think that there's an element of, you know, again, talking about her influence in kind of feminism and culture and stuff, do you think that there's some Annie Lennox influence in there, as Simon would suggest?
How interesting. Yeah, let me think. Obviously, there is the girl power element. I would imagine Annie Lennox would hear that and go, oh, I'm not sure about them saying that. She'd be like, yeah. I was lucky enough, actually, to I've heard her speak a couple of times at an International Women's Day breakfast that I go to every year, and she's a supporter of the charity. And she's just incredible in that space. She really is, and works incredibly hard, I know, is extending her own charity. But that aside, in terms of musically, I agree with you. I can't draw direct comparisons, but perhaps she just sort of paved the way for that independence and that freedom for women at the time, in that decade, to go at it alone, you know? Yeah, I mean, I love the Spice Girls. I've actually been listening back to 90s music this week. So yeah, that's been quite refreshing. But now I can't draw a comparison, but I have to probably listen back to the music and see if there have been any direct sort of links in terms of like the melodies and stuff. But no, that's interesting.
So Annie started work with producer Stephen Lipson and engineer Hef Mares in April 1991, converting the top floor of a home into a studio. In Lucy Ellis's Annie Lennox, the biography, Annie recalls, Steve and Hef took all their equipment with them and set up in the top room, and we recorded there in the house until my husband was almost driven to distraction. The neighbours almost had us thrown out. So this must have been a really chaotic time. But do you think with what we're talking about in terms of Annie finding herself and becoming a mother and this kind of journey into kind of a solo career, do you think there was maybe a part of it that needed to do this in her own space and perhaps for the first time do things her way?
Oh, 100%. I can completely relate to that. You know, I think every artist evolves. You know, you can't be sort of stuck in your own way. Transformation and exploration is so important. And actually, what's also important, while it sounds quite strange, are those experiences and those painful experiences and throwing yourself into them. And you know, I've moved around over the last few years, and it's been something that actually has been a positive influence. While the frustration of, you know, we all know moving and the upheaval and the uncertainty, it's thrown me into a state of creativity. And there's, you know, without a shadow of a doubt, Annie Lennox probably needed those things, those changes, those movements in life to really, yeah, create that gut feeling, those painful emotional instincts to write her greatest work. So yeah, for sure.
And I think that ties in really nicely with kind of what I've got here next, because I think what's always struck me about her solo work is how different it is, as we've talked about, from what's come before. But it feels so familiar, and obviously the voice is a big part of that. I mean, Pop Dose put it really nicely, I think, and they said, during her Eurythmics days, Lennox had become known for a powerful voice and an edgy, androgynous image, but with Diva, we get to hear and see the softer, more vulnerable, more feminine side. She's still exploring themes like love, heartbreak, and sexual politics, but in a way I don't think she fully could working with Dave Stewart. Diva's sound is warmer, and its lyrics are more personal. As much as I loved Eurythmics Lennox, I was totally captivated by Diva Lennox. I mean, obviously, it sounds like we would agree with that. Almost a warmer, more open Annie Lennox on this album.
100%. I think going back to your question a little while ago about that transition from Eurythmics and moving away, you know, I sort of said from a slightly more synthetic synthy world. Obviously, that's still prevalent in this, but it is. It's the warmth, I think, that's exactly it. That she has sort of created here and enhanced. Yeah, absolutely.
And I mean, throughout her career, Annie Lennox has always been as much of a fashion icon as a musical one. And that, obviously, that androgynous style as part of the Eurythmics was iconic and perfect for their sound. How do you think that that image evolved as we head into the diva era, particularly if we think about maybe the album cover or the video for Walking on Broken Glass, things like that?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I would say that she is her own, she is a style icon, isn't she? She is her own sort of definition of feminine. And I mean, even just looking at this album cover here, I think there's a vibrancy. I think there's a femininity. And also I think it's far more diva. Looking back at some of her stuff with the Eurythmics, I think it feels a little more angular, a little more, I don't want to say cold because we keep saying that, but this is all far more, it feels even more exploratory, but with a more feminine twist. Mm. But again, with her iconic haircut. I think I'm just trying to sort of dig it out from my memory, but I'm pretty sure she explores, you know, her own sort of the makeup and everything a little more in this phase. Yeah, it just feels like she was covering new ground, I think, for sure. Just like, you know, her writing, I think she was definitely branching out and spreading her wings, perhaps again to know Little Bird. You know, it's that kind of feeling of openness and release and exploration.
So upon its release, Diva was hugely successful both critically and commercially. I'd argue it actually eclipsed the success of any Eurythmics album. It certified 4 times platinum in the UK. If I'm honest, again, with all her success, I tend to think of her as a solo artist first and half of the Eurythmics second at this point. That's just my personal feelings on it. But before we go track by track, why do you think that is? How do you think that she managed to eclipse this amazing work? We've talked so much about how successful they were. How do you think that she managed to eclipse all of that for so many of us?
Well, for a start, it all comes down to the song, doesn't it? And the writing and the connect. Every single song on this album, and then obviously looking into her second album, it's very difficult to trump a great first album, and she managed to do it. And I think when people think of Annie Lennox, they will often say No More I Love Yous, and you know that wasn't even on this album. So she has managed to convincingly and honestly create a body of work that takes you on a journey, that leaves you feeling emotional, provokes all emotions. Again, I had to come back to that thing of it being on her own, it being solo. It's not as though she's, well, I know, you know, obviously there are always people wrapped around these things, but the fact that she went from being a duo to a solo artist, and not just a solo artist who collaborated, but a solo artist who did it solo, I think that all played a part in this. Almost emerging as something that was fully formed, but she took a step back and unpicked and then reworked something from the ground up herself, which I think is, again, quite a powerful message to artists, actually. And obviously the audience always knows when something is deeply from the heart. So yeah, I think there are many reasons why we connect with this album, why she's been able to do it so effectively. But I think it's because ultimately it just comes completely from her. And it probably came at a time where she'd experienced things that she'd never experienced before, I would imagine. You know, as you say, the birth of a child, heartbreak, success, and having to live up to those expectations again as a woman at the time.
So now seems the perfect time to go track by track. And we've talked about why quite a lot already. Absolutely, one of her most well-known songs. Not only our album opener, but the first single released from Diva. It's, as we say, it's so well-known. Thinking about it kind of as the opening of this album, how does it fare as an opening track, as an opening statement for her career on her own?
Wow, what an opener. To open on a question as well, mm-hmm. I think is an interesting one. It's intriguing, but it's also such beautiful, easy listening. And I'm pleased she's done this, because I went through a phase of always believing that you have to be answering a question on your first song, that you should be opening with a, this is who I am, or an indication of what the album's going to sound like, or but let's be clever about it. This completely turns that on its head. This is just a great song in its own right that is an opener that speaks for itself and is relatively unrelated to, you know, what's coming next. It's just a fantastic song, and that's the way it should be. But yeah, as I say, I think the main thing that strikes a chord here is the why. How many times do I have to tell you? You know, it's just questions, it's mysterious, and it draws you in.
I mean, Stereo Gum saved the song. Diva's first single remains an enduring classic. A bold enough move to have your first single be a torch ballad of regret, but this one is a weeper for the ages. So there's no disputing, as we've said, it's a heavy hitter emotionally. Would you agree? Do you think it is a ballsy move for this not only to open an album, but to be the first single of your solo career to be like, this is the beginning?
I'm all about a ballsy moment. I think if you're going to emerge on your own and you've got the talent that she has, I think why not be ballsy about it? This is why I love it. Yeah, absolutely. And you know, if they wouldn't have known that this was going to be a song, you know, obviously people know to a point that they love a song before they release it to the public, but you never quite know how it's going to resonate. So, you know, they obviously went with their feeling on it, and just so happens that it's probably, I don't know if you'd say it's, yeah, I'd say it is the most well-known off this track listing now.
And it's funny, you know, talking about it kind of resonating with people. I mean, I remember my parents playing this one on car journeys when I was a kid. Even then, kind of just being, what, like 6, 7, 8 years old, that it packing this real, like, emotional punch. And so much of that has to be down to that vocal delivery. Entertainment Weekly have said, and I love this, they said that Annie languorously stretches that word across several measures as if she were unfurling a length of satin. I think that's a really nice way of putting it.
Oh my God, yeah. I think, yes, her voice is satin. Her voice, it's got so many different tones, such beauty to it, and dynamics. And that is something that I think is very difficult to capture in a song without making it sound too dramatic or cheesy. And she just does it in a really cool way. So, yeah.
And I know that obviously much of our conversation, it's been about Annie's emotional, lyrical evolution, and that's certainly reflected musically too. And so Music and Media comment that the singer confidently goes adult contemporary on her first solo effort. It's gently moving and highly polished. She could hardly move farther away from the stirring rock of Eurythmics. And again, it's interesting because, again, you were saying earlier on, it was something that had stuck with me as well. I wouldn't particularly call Eurythmics rock. Diva, you know, Apple Music, it's down as rock. You know, again, this kind of thing of trying to sort of put things into labels, into genre almost. Do you think that with the temptation of not doing that, and, you know, do you feel that there is a huge musical shift away from that Eurythmic sound, and that why is quite a big statement in that regard?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I wonder how much sort of comparison they did, and how much looking back she did when she was writing this, and whether she was actually really trying to make a defining shift. For sure, she was to a point, and I'm sure, you know, Dave Stewart's influence is probably, you know, different to hers. While they obviously were aligned in many ways, there were probably things that she wanted to explore on her own. So yeah, I think absolutely. And when you say adult contemporary, I would say this is, well, adult contemporary now, sadly, is not a term that people use so much because they deem it as uncool now. Mm. But perhaps they're looking back at, you know, it's, you know, more heritage acts. But this is, I mean, adult contemporary music, if you can create a timeless piece like this, you know, you are hitting an audience that is so widespread just because they're fantastic songs. I think Adele is a prime example of an artist that is the modern day adult contemporary artist. Mm-hmm. And has created something that is impactful and of a time when, you know, when I think everybody needed that that sort of album and sound. So yes, sorry, I've strayed slightly there, but
no, it's okay.
Yes, to your point.
Yeah. I mean, we've talked a lot about that impact that a professional split with Dave Stewart had on both of them. And interestingly, what you'd said earlier on, which again, I would agree with, I've never heard any talk about the inspiration behind Why, or if it's about someone or something in particular. Dave has claimed that Why is actually about their relationship. And he said it was probably the first time she had a chance to sit down and say what happened. When I first heard the song, and still when I hear it, I can hear every piece of pain that she put into it. When she sings, "Do You Know How I Feel?" it left a question. We've met hundreds of times since then, and we never discuss our songs about each other. It's opening up a can of worms. Who knows what will come out? And I guess we'll never know if that's true, and in some ways I wouldn't want to. But again, that potentially adds a very raw layer to this song, that if perhaps that first statement that we're hearing is about that relationship with Dave, be it professional, be it personal, however that comes across.
Interesting, isn't it? And I've noticed that she's not, you know, she doesn't give much away in terms of what these songs are actually about, which is quite lovely, I think, because a song should obviously be about the person that has written them. Not always, but, you know, it's got to come from somewhere, or their experience. But it's also about, you know, the stories of people that listen to these songs as well. You know, I think we're in these lyrics, however we choose to take them. So yeah, interesting that he has said that.
So let's move on to another huge single now. So Walking on Broken Glass, more upbeat offering. We were talking a little bit about that juxtaposition between kind of the lyrics and the music before. You know, we often talk on My Classic Album about the deliberate nature of track placement. And I know you'd said earlier on, you really like how we come out of Why into Walking on Broken Glass. You know, do you think that's a very deliberate thing that she's done when she's been kind of working out where these tracks are going to go on Diva?
I think so. I think, you know, as you said earlier, there is a certain darkness, a bluesiness. She likes a minor chord. I think at this point the album had to open up. There had to be that, you know, that degree of excitement, which obviously can be generated from a song like Why, which it is. But, you know, we needed to up the beat a little bit. And this song definitely has a feeling of euphoria about it. It puts a smile on your face, again, even though it's, you know, a song that lyrically perhaps isn't about just that. Something that I thought about when, you know, because I've heard this song 150 million times, but how fantastically musical it is, that introduction. There's no denying what it is when it starts playing. And another, you know, reflection that I've had about this album, if you look at the track listing and the length of the songs, you know, we've got a over five minute, followed by 5 minute, 6.28, just long songs, full songs that take you on a journey. I love that.
Yeah.
I love that there was, you know, no question about, you know, cutting it short, radio edits, oh no, you're going to lose the audience's attention if you don't. Why is 4 minutes 53? Mm-hmm. Great. Can people kindly do that more?
Yeah, exactly. And I think Walking on Rotten Glass is a great example of what Annie was talking about earlier in one of those quotes, that she's happy, but not naturally a happy person, you know. And Spectrum Culture singles out this song, saying for an album that creates such an inviting world, Diva is pessimistic about the one in which we live. The breakup songs are melodramatic in the depths of pain. Walking on Broken Glass is an awfully violent metaphor for such a jaunty skip to Malou of a song. And I had a bit of a think about that as I was kind of reading that, and it made me think, you know, is that kind of, and obviously we'll talk about the music video in a minute, but do you think it's almost in that same way that we often wear masks to hide that emotional turmoil? I think of, say, REM, The One I Love, that people play that at weddings. It's actually a very dark song. You know, again, Walking on Broken Glass sort of falls into that category a little bit.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, it really does. It's actually, when people interview me about my albums, it's a point that I often raise, because I would say there's always, you know, in my writing, there's a bit of a juxtaposition. And while I've created an album. It's called This Woman's Heart. It's been divided into two parts. And actually what I tried to do was put on the first part, I call it the darker half of the heart. And it was all about sort of the heartbreaks and the emotional journey that I'd gone through at a certain point in life. And the second part of the album was a more optimistic, brighter future, songs that felt a little more resolved. Now, it was quite difficult to actually do that, I realised, because, you know, people would say, well, is it sonically that it's more upbeat, or is it the lyric? And actually, it was, for me, it was all about the lyric and the sentiment. And on the second part of the album, I've got a song called Celebrate. And that is a song that is probably the saddest to darkest song to a degree, because it's a song about death. It's a song about loss. You're never going to get a person back. But it's called Celebrate. And in the chorus, there is a sense of sort of collaborative, there's multiple voices singing Celebrate. And actually, I put it on the second part of the album, the resolve part, because it's about celebrating life. It's celebrating death. It's a sentiment that we all have, an unfortunate journey that we all have to go through and navigating those very sad times, but it is life. And I think from those experiences we need to take the positives of shared experiences with those people and celebrate those. I can completely understand, you know, now, and I'm interested listening back to this, to Diva, because it is, you know, all of her songs are sort of tinged with that juxtaposition of happiness, but ultimately there is a questioning. There's a deep, you know, Annie is an intelligent woman who is questioning life, relationships, yeah, everything at this moment, and very beautifully. So, yeah.
And it's interesting hearing you talk about your process a little bit, because that ties in quite nicely with my next question. That, you know, while the likes of Why, as we've established, very personal, Annie told Q magazine that a song like Walking on Broken Glass was more of a case of her telling a story and getting into a character. So she said, I've always loved R&B, and I had that in mind when I was singing. In fact, I'd think of myself as a very old black man, and I know I've got no right to imagine I know what that is, but in my way, I stepped into that persona. So obviously, you've talked about, obviously, with your album just there, that, you know, it's very personal, kind of almost kind of split into these two very distinct sections in terms of kind of the heart. Do you relate to that in your songwriting, that maybe sometimes it is more about storytelling than kind of personal stuff? Or do you feel that that's something where you would maybe differ from Annie in terms of songwriting?
For me, in an album, I love taking people on a journey. So yeah, when you say storytelling, absolutely, there's definitely a story to be told with This Woman's Heart. Yeah, it was sort of a 2-year period sandwiched into an album, I would say. So I think I'm taking people through that. Obviously, my songs aren't always about me. I listen to, you know, I'm influenced by friends, family, things that I hear in the greater world. This is why this time's been so difficult, because I do love to travel to get my inspirations for these things, and haven't been able to do that. But yeah, for sure, it is all about storytelling for me. Yeah, and finding a way to sort of paint a picture that I hope is something that can be related to by other people and not just me.
So, of course, anyone who's seen this can't not think of the music video. So obviously it's based on the movie Dangerous Liaisons and other kind of period dramas.
Yeah.
Annie stars with Hugh Laurie, who I'm almost certain kind of reprises his role from Blackadder the Third. Like, it's very, very similar. And John Malkovich, in a video that got lots of play on VH1, contributed to the song becoming a huge hit. I mean, what do you make of the video? Like, there's funny moments, there's really sad moments. I mean, what do you think of it?
Absolutely. And I think it's a character piece, isn't it, for her? I think we see personality, we see independence, we see flamboyance, that she doesn't take herself too seriously. And also, I think confidence. I think this is a very bold move. There's nothing vanilla about it. It's a real character, and her pulling dramatic faces, her wearing dramatic clothes. I think it's very distinctive, very feminine, and incredibly cool. That's something else about Annie Lennox. I've always just thought she is just, because she is so herself, there's nothing cooler. There's nothing, I think, you can't respect anyone more than for just being so sort of centered in themselves. And I've never really questioned that. Obviously, you know, you said earlier that she was having dark moments and going through all these things and took a step back, but she seems to deliver with complete conviction. I respect that hugely.
So we'll move on to Precious. Precious was actually the second single off the album following Why. It wasn't quite as successful on the singles chart, so it's number 23 in the UK. I don't think it really charted at all in the US. Pop does say it's a great song, but I don't think it was a strong choice for the follow-up to a single like Why. In my opinion, the smarter move would have been to release what wound up being the third single, Walking on Broken Glass, instead. Do you think that's true? Do you think there's a reason that Precious wasn't received as well?
It's interesting, isn't it? And I thought a little bit about, because I hadn't been aware that Precious was a single, because obviously we know Why and Walking on Broken Glass. Now, do we know those because they're better tracks? Do we know those because they've had more exposure? I mean, I love Precious. For me, it doesn't quite have the edge that the other two have, but I think there's this beautiful sort of space in it. We really hear Annie's voice soar. It has sort of space for those you know, nice high notes, as well as a cool bass line and things. I think they're probably right in saying that it's not as strong as the other two, but I don't believe that means that it shouldn't have come out as a second single. She released 5 singles off this album, so I think it's good to pace yourself. And if you have to release, I mean, you notice it now on Spotify, people are releasing single after single after single. But generally people, you know, because they're releasing every 2 weeks or some of them, you know, I know I remember Taylor Swift releasing a second single after 2 weeks. She didn't put out her strongest second single off her previous album, Second. It was just something to kind of keep the interest peaking. So I would imagine, you know, that this probably helps sustain that. And we can't forget this is a debut album, but Annie is also a name, and she would have had a fan base at this point. We're talking about a comparison with some of the greatest songs of that decade. So, you know, to live up to those expectations is quite difficult for every song. So, yeah, and you know, I have always enjoyed it. And again, as part of this album, it carries you. It carries you into the next. So, which is also important in a song. Songs on an album, you know, not every song needs to shout hit single.
I mean, this is a song that Annie actually has spoken out about a little bit, and she said in 2009 about Precious, "It's a very personal, sweet song. I lost my first baby, and when you lose a child, you have to carry on in life without them being a continuing part of it. It changes the entire way you see everything. Further on down the line, my daughter was safely brought into the world, and I wrote this song for her because I was just so profoundly grateful for her existence. Now I have 2 daughters and the dedication extends to both my girls. So that now the title is plural because I love them both equally with the passion of a mother." And I think it's lovely knowing the context behind that, because again, it's almost thinking about where she was and the journey she was on. This is almost her kind of coming out of the other side of all of that adversity we were talking
Absolutely.
About.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And such, you know, such heartbreak, but honesty, huge things to be going through in your life, a life-changing things. So yeah, absolutely.
And I think it's lovely to think too, you know, and I'd said earlier on there that obviously Lola is now embarking on her own journey into music, and she is actually someone that I've reached out to see if we can get her on the podcast in the near future.
Fantastic. Wow.
Yeah.
She does a lot with her mum as well. You might get her in the background.
But I think it's cool because I just think, again, obviously thinking about where her career is going and that momentum's picking up, it brings things full circle, doesn't it? Obviously, we're talking about Annie and all of the stuff that was going on at the time of this album, and then now her daughter's starting on this career of her own, which is lovely.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I've actually been following her too, as an Annie fan. She's doing fantastically, and Radio 2 lover, mm-hmm. and blasting out her tunes. So it's great, you know. And it's I often imagine the conversation she has with her mum, because, you know, she is starting a career in an industry that is very different to what it was 30 years ago when her mum was, you know, emerging. I wonder what sort of advice she gets. She's very lucky, I would say. Love my mum, but she can't quite give me the same advice.
And that's literally the first two tracks. Huge anthems for Annie Lennox. Still in a fantastic album to get through. A really quite eclectic album in some ways. My chat with Reva Taylor continues very shortly indeed, chatting all about this fantastic album, Diva, by Annie Lennox. Obviously, if you want to get in on the conversation, if you've got thoughts about this album, if you've got thoughts about Nevermind, again, I'm encouraging you to get in touch. Social media channels are the way to go. My Classic Album with Mike Norris on Facebook, My Classic Album Podcast on Instagram, or indeed at @MCA_podcast on Twitter. All of that information, of course, as always, on www.myclassicalbum.co.uk. And now some music from our fantastic guest today, Reva Taylor. You'll have heard Reva talking a little bit there about her album, This Woman's Heart, which is kind of released in two parts. Point one came out last year. Point two came out in May of this year. Here's a fantastic standout track from that second collection of songs. This is Reva Taylor with In Love No More.
Talk anymore. I'm two steps forwards, making sense of it all. I wish that I could wish you well with a call, you know. 'Cause you gotta fly before you. Faces and the faces and the chaos of it all. Ooh, we fall through the messy little pieces that we threw across the floor. Hold me now, no, no more. Just hold. Thread.
Let's move on to Legend in My Living Room. So you'd said most of the songs are Annie's and Annie's Alone. This is one of two songs on the album where she shares writing credit. So in this case, Peter John Vitesse, who's known as a member of Jethro Tull. So we've talked about what a personal album this is. Do you think that Legend in My Room stands out because there's kind of another voice in that song, so to speak?
It's interesting because I love the lyrics in this one. And I'm assuming it's direct from her heart, even though it's collaborative. You know, when I was just 17, I ran away from home to be with all the pretty people, to be on my own. Bright lights and trains and bedsit stains and pavements paved with gold. And I believed in everything that everybody told me. Have mercy on me, have mercy on me. And I wonder whether there's a shared sentiment there with him. You know, this must be her story, her adventures of moving away, exploring music, life, the world of celebrity, whatever it is. But I wonder whether some of his experiences have crept in here. So it's an interesting one, because for me, when I read that only two songs had not been penned solely by her, I wasn't able to say, oh, I know the one it will be. Which I think probably shows that these songs have been written with the correct writing partner. I can hold my hand up because I have definitely written songs with the wrong people in the past. It's so important when you collaborate with someone that you have the same vision, you have a connection. You know what, I've written with some people that I would say are absolutely brilliant. They have written songs for great artists and great songs, and we haven't written a fantastic song together, a song that I would, you know, I even released. And those have been learning lessons for me, because I think perhaps we just come from a different place. And the songs that I have often written with either unknown writers, or I shouldn't say unknown writers, but artists maybe who haven't had the number one hit, but we have the right connection and we're honest with each other, because that's obviously a huge part. If you can be honest about your stories and put those into song with somebody, that's more important than anything. And clearly, whoever's story this is here in this song, you know, they have been able to create this together and also allow it to fit very sincerely with the other songs that have been written by Annie. So yeah, I think it's a hit for me in that reason, in that regard. So yeah, you don't think twice. It's a brilliant song.
I mean, musically, Legend in My Living Room, at least to me anyway, it feels much closer to what we'd come to have expected from Annie's time in Eurythmics. I think even the vocal delivery kind of harkens back to those days a little bit. I mean, what do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. It feels a little more... Have you seen the music video as well?
I haven't. No, not for this one.
It's a little... it feels a little sort of more jarring and starker. I don't... It takes it away from that sort of... that warmth and that sort of expansiveness that I think that she has in her songs like Why. And actually, looking at the video, she's again quite sort of dramatic. She's playing up to the diva, but she's, it's all monochrome and it's a little colder. And yeah, I think for sure it's an interesting observation that maybe when, you know, maybe when she's in that collaborative space, she changes slightly back to where she was before, which again I don't think is a bad thing, because I think she would have carried with her a lot of Eurythmic fans who will probably expect a certain sound. I think to a point you do have to give people, you know, what they want and what they expect. I think, you know, she's obviously made a step away from the space she was in before, but go any further and then you do end up, you know, losing people that love what you're about. But this song has allowed her to be, I think, that I smiled a bit at the video when I was watching it yesterday, her to be dramatic as well. So yeah, it's just, there's so much creativity, I think, in what she does, and performance, different ways of exploring the diva as well. you know, in this video, she's wearing a top hat, and you know, there's an masculinity about it again, which makes it very cool. So yeah, shows her strength as a female.
So let's move on to Cold. So another track chosen as a single from the album has that kind of somber tone of Why, a wonderful showcase of her voice. And I know you'd said earlier on, and it's something that kind of latched on for me there, that you feel like this song's maybe influenced you more than you first realized. Mm. I mean, why do you think that is?
Yeah, I went through an interesting time in my life, because I started off, obviously I was influenced by singers like Annie, but my mum loved singers like Streisand. I was in the West End as a kid. I came from that place. And when I got my first record deal at the age of 12, I was actually signed to a classic meets adult contemporary label. So the music that I was singing was very different to the songs I was singing now. You know, I think part and parcel of it being right at the time, what do you make a 12-year-old sing? I was writing poetry in my bedroom, but none of that had been brought out. I was just a singer that sang other people's songs at that time. Now, that chapter went on until I was about 18, 19 with that label. I then took a few years out of the industry completely. It was a time that I had never had before, actually. I'd always been juggling school with my career, and that was quite a nice natural pause just to be a student for a little bit. But music was never too far away from what I did, and I ended up writing my final dissertation on the exploitation of rhythm and blues artists during the civil rights era in America. So what it allowed me to do was listen to rock and roll and rhythm and blues music for a good year. While obviously I knew the artists, I got to look at the Beatles, but also at some amazing rock and roll artists at the time. My ear was keyed into a very different sound, and it reminded me, it started to open my eyes up at the age of, you know, what was I, 19 to sort of 21 years old, of music and genres and fusion. And I then carried into my next chapter, when I then started writing properly for myself, that sound. And I think that's when Annie Lennox then came back into my life, and I realised how important she had been, because a lot of the songs in the South, people would say, you know, there are a lot of blue notes going on here. There's a lot of, and my voice had changed as well from that period before. It was a lot deeper, and people started to say, there's an Annie Lennox about you. And I thought, how interesting. And I think it took maybe those years, exposure to that sound, and obviously just general maturing, to make people's ears go, right, okay, that's now a thing which I'd never heard before. And yeah, it was just after writing a few songs that I thought, oh God, I feel like this song's been written. And it was actually, Cold was one of the songs I thought, oh, okay, it's verging into that territory here. Got to be careful, because that song's already been written. So yeah, and I still love it when this song comes on. It's just got something about it, a just complete sort of sincerity, ease, and cool.
And I know, obviously, Annie Lennox's biography that I've quoted from a few times so far says, this is another song which does not appear to be born of a contented lifestyle, as she sings of an unrequited love, which is so right, yet unattainable. And I wonder, you know, obviously we've talked about this kind of, that song, you know, that quote talks about that song being at conflict with this now contented lifestyle that she's living. Do you think that's a battle that we're hearing across the album, these moments of uncertainty and darkness against some of these more content moments?
Yeah, 100%. It's definitely an album of motion. You know, she's not stuck in a state of depression. I think she's been through perhaps the lows, but she's constantly questioning her every move. I think it's very reflective of the person that she is, which is, you know, one that does question, and we know that she only sort of hopes to improve life for women for the better. But with that, you have to be constantly sort of reviewing and connecting with the deep and the meaningful and selfless. And I think that's perhaps what we're seeing here. She has a selflessness about her, I think, Annie. I think there's a depth to her writing, mm-hmm. which is, am I worthy? Am I worthy of this life? And when you said earlier about her questioning, you know, playing her masterpieces to a manager, you know, there's a lack of complete confidence, which is very human. And I think that's what she is. And I think that's why she's so intriguing, because she's, you know, a lot of people would say she's superhuman, because she's a genius. You know, she is an incredible writer. She's beautiful. She's got, you know, she's got confidence and creativity, but she's also got vulnerability. And I think she strikes that balance. And that's why the world loves her.
And I think interestingly, and I'm going to have a bit more of a dive to see whether this is true, because it's a really interesting little statistic if it is. I've read somewhere that Cold was the first single ever released in the UK that wasn't released on 7-inch vinyl.
Really?
Yeah, and instead, this bit I do know to be true, instead, quite uniquely, there were 3 CD singles released. So there was Cold, Colder, and Coldest. So they all had Cold on, but the B-sides were different depending on which one you had. So Cold's B-sides were Diva-era tracks sang at Annie's MTV Unplugged performance in July 1992. Colder had Eurythmics era tracks from that same session, and then Coldest had cover versions that she'd done at that performance. So I must admit, I've never heard any of Annie's Unplugged set, but it definitely makes me want to check it out. But I thought, what a really unique way to kind of release a single.
Oh my God, totally. Yeah, how interesting. I'm going to go and check that out.
So let's move on to what I think is a pretty underrated song on the album, Money Can't Buy It. So, I mean, I presumed it was an album track, which of course it is, but I did find an article at Vancouver Signature Sounds that reveals it was released as a single in the US, but it didn't chart. I mean, what are your thoughts on Money Can't Buy It? Because I do think it's maybe been a bit forgotten by some of these other heavy hitters that we've been talking about.
It's an album track for me, for sure, because it doesn't stop me in my tracks the way that perhaps some others do, but sonically it doesn't do that, because it has a sort of, there's a drive to it. It's an interesting one, because obviously it's a song about love and basically money can't buy the things in life that are the most important is what I take from it. I don't know if you agree on that.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's like you say, I think again it says a lot about where she was at that point in her career, that, you know, all these other things that she could have with money, but as you say, love, you know, these, you know, the important things are the things that we can't buy.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think now I've always got to be sensitive about this, because it feels like I'm deconstructing and pulling apart an album that I love. Mm. But in terms of that concept, it's a concept that's quite digestible. Mm-hmm. It's a concept that has been written about and will be written about again, that you can't put value on love. And perhaps that is why it doesn't stand out to us, or at least doesn't sort of, yeah, it doesn't stand out like those other tracks, but is a song that would certainly be played yeah. and enjoyed. And hell, a lot of songs that don't match up to this get played on the radio these days. Mm-hmm. But yeah. The question is it going to be here in 30 years time? And those ones definitely won't be. These ones still are, but the songs that still, as in, get played on radio, that people still want to cover, are the songs that we have referenced, and obviously that this one isn't that. But interesting if it was played in the States, and I think very often, or released in the States, very often these, you know, songs have a market in a territory. Mm-hmm. I noticed that she had a different release for Japan, which is something that I had on my first album. I had to record 3 more songs for the Japanese market. Yeah, I think it's just different ears and different territories.
And I think perhaps, and you know, this might just be me making complete assumptions here, but for me, it's the most memorable part of the song, and perhaps maybe why it was chosen as a single in America, is that bridge where she's essentially rapping during the bridge at that point,
yeah.
which I think to anyone listening, who hasn't heard it, that sounds like it wouldn't be her forte. For me, I don't know what it is about it. For me, that section does work. And I know that obviously when other artists have kind of tried to go into that territory, it's not always worked. For me, it feels like it shouldn't work, but it does. I mean, what do you think of that point of the song?
I absolutely think it works. Yeah. This is what I love about Annie Lennox. And we get all sort of different influences just infiltrating into her songs every now and again. And because I think from her videos and we get to know her personality, and that is quite bold and that is quite sort of groundbreaking. None of this surprises me. I love it. I love it. I really do. And I love those dynamic moments in her songs when she raises her voice and she almost, I don't want to say she shouts, but it is a belt in her voice, in her very melodic voice that is completely original. Yeah, so no, please, more of that.
And I mean, fansite EurythmicsUltimate.com, they were ranking, as they called the list, 100 beautiful Annie Lennox songs, and they put Money Can't Buy It as number 10. And they said of the song, other than the bonus track cover, Keep Young and Beautiful, which we'll touch on towards the end, no other diva track takes quite a pointed swipe at the album's ironic title. Would you agree with that? Because I guess the rap section, the fact that she's rapping it, all the things that she's rapping about, that could almost be a bit of a swipe at that kind of diva tag or label, if you like.
Yeah. Oh, it was a bit of a swipe at a feminine sort of diva.
Yeah, or like kind of the label that would come with calling someone a diva.
Calling someone a diva. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. You know, I got the diamonds, all of that kind of stuff. Yeah. Yeah. Really interesting point, actually. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
So let's move on to Little Bird, which again is the one that you've said's probably been on your Spotify playlist for as long as that's been possible. And I think it's, again, you think about her career and you think about all these huge songs, I'd forgotten Little Bird was on this album until I went back to it.
I mean, I don't know. Is Little Bird a song that you think of when you think of Annie Lennox? Because it could just be me and it could just be a favourite of mine. I'm unsure whether it's, you know, a song that stands up to Why and Walking on Broken Glass for everyone else. But for me, it's a song that just provokes such happiness when I listen to it that it's just one that I've carried with me.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. I think for a lot of people, I mean, it was a huge hit here in the UK. So I think for a lot of people, it would have been. I think for me, again, the kind of songs we were talking about there, like Why and Walking on Broken Glass, No More, I Love Yous. I love Dark Road that she released probably about 15 years ago now. So they're the songs that immediately jump into my head to the point where it was almost kind of a pleasant surprise when Little Bird came on. It was like kind of meeting up with an old friend for the first time in a long time. It was really nice.
Yeah, no, it's definitely got that feeling for me as well.
Yeah, does it feel? I know that Billboard call it a synth-driven thumper that harks back to her early Eurythmics tenure. Does it feel like a callback to those days, or would you disagree?
Don't think it steps back quite that far, but I understand what they mean. Obviously, it's synth-driven. That introduction, I don't, you know, I would sing it, but I'll sound quite special. But, you know, how she uses her voice as a, you know, as a hook, the, you know, and that introduction as well. Yeah, I can see the comparison. It feels, yes, synth-driven as opposed to that, like I said, you know, a slightly more sort of organic approach the song, but it also, you know, fits perfectly. Interesting position. I think it needed to come at this point in the album. You know, it could also have sat as the second song on the album, but I think position wise it works as it is. You know, hit us with another corker at that point that gets your foot tapping.
Spin magazine called Little Bird the album's finest track. They say it's call and response woo-woos, exude genuine confidence, cleverness and craft. And I know this is really hard and I know, obviously, when I think about my favourite albums, if someone says to me, like, which is the best track, that's always, like, it's like choosing between your favourite child. For you, is it one of, or is it in, would you say it is the finest track on the album?
I think I've got, oh, God, it's so difficult. Oh, it's so difficult, actually, just looking at them. Mm-hmm. No, it's not for me. But I think it would be Why. And do I say Little Bird trumps Walking on Broken Glass? I just don't know if I can say that. I think they're both on a par.
So it's certainly up there.
I think, yeah, it's definitely, yes, it's getting a medal.
Yeah. I mean, it's another song with it. I mean, to be fair, we've referenced the music videos kind of all the way through, but another song with a really memorable video. Obviously, Annie's quite heavily pregnant in this one as the host. She's almost like a ringmaster, like hosting a cabaret or something, starring lookalikes that represent her in different stages of her career. So for the videos to say Sweet Dreams Are Made of These, There Must Be an Angel, even her appearance at the Freddie Mercury tribute concert. So, I mean, I love the video. I think it's a true reflection of how far she's come at this point, really, when she's, obviously, because I think this was the last single released on the album, if I remember rightly.
I think, yes, obviously, by your last single, first album that's been a hit, people have really started to, sort of, you know, get to know you. And this, I think this does only enhance that, doesn't it? You know, you see the full Annie on show. So, yeah.
So we'll move on to Primitive, another maybe kind of underrated track, perhaps. The blog Then Play Long describes the song beautifully, saying where the album works is when Lennox holds back and lets the music and her feelings wash over any expectations of commercial crossover. Primitive gets very close to the transcendence, which I suspect Lennox was seeking all along. I mean, would you agree with that? Because I think one thing I've learned from my classic album is, you know, album tracks, they're not just tracks that aren't good enough to be released as a single. Do you know what I mean? It's the art of the album and a journey it takes you on.
Absolutely.
Is Primitive a good example of that?
I think so. And, you know, this album has got such variety in terms of the songs and the structures. And, you know, Primitive is one of those. There's no clear chorus, pre-chorus, you know, it's, and there's repetition in the Sweetheart. At the start of each of the, if we're calling them verses or sections, it's its own little, it's its own song. There's nothing unpredictable about it. There's nothing predictable about it. So, yeah, I also really like it for that reason, as you say, you know, an underrated song purely because it hasn't been recognised as a lead single on an incredibly strong album.
Yeah.
But a song that, you know, without this, the album wouldn't be the same.
So again, to return to Annie's biography, they say the track, they say Primitive is calmer and more relaxing. The synthetic strings are Beatles-esque and the spiritual atmosphere completes the mystique. I guess when you think about the influence the Beatles have had on popular music, you could always argue there's a Beatles vibe somewhere. But can you hear that particularly in the strings on this one?
Yes. Yeah, actually, I think, again, because there's this space created on this one, there's a reflectiveness, it's moved away from that drive of a song like Little Bird. Yeah, we can really hear those strings. Yeah, of course, you know, she grew up in an era where the Beatles were at the forefront of everything, and also influencing, you know, or, you know, they have been influenced by the rock and roll, by the blues that I was talking about earlier, and where her, clearly her sound and her influences come from as well. So it's unsurprising that there'd be any comparison drawn there or any influence throughout her music. So yeah, for sure.
And I think obviously there's very much a kind of a Middle Eastern kind of feel to the song in places, and that apparently came from her time living in France. So Annie had said, the human voice can be produced in many different ways. I've heard these Arabic women and they stand in line and produce this wobble that comes from somewhere, and it's terrifying but thrilling at the same time. And I think it's like we've said a couple of times, it's amazing to kind of hear, obviously, someone who is so inspirational and influential to so many people, to hear where her influence and her inspiration comes from. And it just helps Diva paint this picture of who she was at this point in her life.
Absolutely. She's so curious, isn't she? And I love that you can be sort of mentioning the Beatles one moment and then the influence from, you know, Arabia and that sound creeping in as well. That is creating something original here. Mm-hmm. There's also a little video you can find of that and her, again, doing her feminine thing, and it's all, you know, ambient sort of dancing, and yeah, it's lovely.
So as we head towards the end of the album, we get to Stay By Me. So Music Musings and Such argue that the album's a bit lopsided in terms of hits. So they say, I can see that Diva is a little lopsided when it comes to arranging the hits in order. I think the strongest moments can be found on the first side, but that's not to say the second side of Diva lacks clout and standouts. Little Bird and Stay With Me are terrific tracks. So obviously they did single it out along with Little Bird as a highlight, but I mean, what do you make of that? Again, we always talk about the journey of an album and that track placement. Do you think that it would benefit from being shuffled about?
No, I don't, actually. And I don't know why. I think if you listen to a lot of albums, naturally the second part, it moves into reflective, the pace slows slightly. It's what happens here. Now, is it that we all have a formula and we stick to it? I don't think so. I think we go with what the heart says. For me, on my latest album, I did exactly the same. It started off with perhaps the more, you know, uplifting, tap your foot, keep you on the edge of your seat, and then, you know, you slow the pace down, and there's definitely some more reflectiveness towards the end of my album. I think they've done exactly the same here. It's almost as though there's some more space being created and opening up. Stay By Me, I think, again, beautiful lyrics, very personal, like she's speaking directly to somebody. I think we needed that pace to slow down to hear that sentiment. And I would agree, I think it's a little sort of a gem of a moment at this time. Yes, it doesn't scream single or radio song or whatever it is, but for me, I don't tend to listen to that. I am, because I think every song has its own place. And, you know, no doubt this will have connected with a lot of people. I think it's beautiful.
And it's funny because I know I like to try and pepper this with criticism sometimes, just in the sake of just kind of saying, getting a full picture. And again, from Annie's biography by Lucy Ellis, she actually had some quite strong criticism for Stay By Me, saying the bass is overpowering in the mix as Annie struggles to be heard over the numerous other instruments in this cluttered song. Finally, she sings of her love for Yuri, her husband, asking that he never leaves her, whatever may happen. Unfortunately, she chose the most unadventurous song in which to do it, as it fails to ignite or even go anywhere. After 6 minutes, this song is a little too much. I mean, that sounds like quite a harsh criticism, I would say. But I mean, what do you think of that?
I'd have to listen back to her about the bass. But no, see, I think for me, this feels very in the moment. And to be talking about your husband, I think there is a deep honesty. It's unpredictable. It feels like it's just totally from the heart. And I think, again, having a 6 minute song to do that in just complements that idea of it just being a spontaneous, deeply felt sentiment. So no, I would disagree on that one.
So we'll move on to The Gift. So this is only the second song on the album that wasn't written solely by Annie. So she collaborated with members of the Scottish band The Blue Nile for this one. Now, I must confess, I've heard very little of The Blue Nile. Do you know much about them? Or
I don't, unfortunately. But I'd be interested to know why she selected them, because I don't think they had a huge currency at the time. No.
Yeah, again, I think it's like you were saying earlier, perhaps about the right people.
The right people. No, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And you said Scottish.
Yeah.
Yeah. So again, you know, there was obviously a common thread there. Yeah, no, it's a beautiful way to end the end at the album.
Which brings me to a really interesting point, because you're right, obviously, for all intents and purposes, this is the end of the album. On many editions of the album, there is a bonus track, which is, you know, obviously, we'll be talking about that shortly, Keep Young and Beautiful. For you, does The Gift feel like the end of the album? Does Keep Young and Beautiful feel like a bonus track? Or do you feel that it's kind of a continuation of Diva?
Keep Young and Beautiful for me is a bit, is a bonus sort of afterthought, something very different. The Gift feels like it is perfectly sort of positioned within the rest. I really love the title of this one. I always have a funny thing about a last track, where it's something that I will often think about when I'm writing the album. And I don't think I'm alone in that. I'm sure, you know, other people listening, if you are musicians, I've heard it a number of times. It sounds like a last track on an album. I don't know what it is about the last track on an album, but people will always think about what that means. Now, is it a parting gift to your listener? This is why I like this title. Is it a parting thought, an afterthought? For me, I have a song called In Love No More, which went as the last track on my latest release. And it felt a little different from the others. It was far more pared back. It was piano and guitar based, felt a bit more organic. I use that word a lot, but it did. And actually, for me, I wanted it to be the last track because it not only did it sort of stray a little from the other songs, but it felt like it was the beginning of a new chapter for me, and actually perhaps sonically where I'm going to be going next. And that felt totally right. So whether, you know, they've chosen this as the last track because it's a collaborative song, perhaps those influences from the other writers have made it that sort of that step away from the others, I'm unsure. But for me, it fits beautifully, but I don't know, you know, it wouldn't fit in the first part of the album for me, let's put it that way.
And I guess it's really interesting you should say that, because I mean Pop Dos have a lot of praise for The Gift, saying they always gravitated towards it, and they call The Gift and Why perfect bookends to the album. Why starts the record with a protagonist lamenting all the things she did wrong to bring about the demise of a relationship? By the time we get to The Gift, she's accepted that things are over, is glad to have had the time she had with a lover, and is ready to move on with her life. And I guess in that sense, again, we talk about Keep Young and Beautiful, and that's not a knock on that track, but I think for me, that's why The Gift does feel like the end of the album, and it is very much a bonus track that we're dealing with.
Yeah, and it is a resolved sentiment, as that review you just said mentions. I think there's quite a nice thing about, I mean, it's leaving on a high, isn't it? You want to know that the person that you've invested the last, whatever it is, 55 minutes in, has gone away, you know, is content in their situation. And that's kind of essentially what Annie's leaving us with here. She's saying that, I have, my fragilities are, you know, a little more stable, and you know that, that she's going to be going on, and you've got the confidence that she's going to be going on and creating more for us, which is a lovely thing. And in a sense, you know, that was a decision for me as well. It was quite, you know, I put the second part of the album out, which was a resolved feeling for everybody. And In Love No More was the last track, which again, I don't think could scream anymore that perhaps I was over the heartbreak. So she's perhaps more sensitively and delicately saying the same thing here.
So, I mean, as the 90s unfolded, the diva was that moment. Annie Lennox transcended an already iconic body of work and solidified herself as one of the greatest female vocalists of all time. Not that I'm biased or anything. I've always felt that the sound, or even on the final Eurythmics album, Peace, in 1999, that felt much more informed by what Annie had done in her solo work rather than what Eurythmics had done. It just felt more of an extension of that. And I think Diffuser sum up the impact of Diva on music as well as Annie's life. And I just want to read that to you now, because I think it sums up what we've been talking about really nicely. So they say, ultimately, Diva announced Lennox as a vital solo artist in her own right, proving her creative strength remained undimmed outside the context of her work with Stewart. Yet as gracefully as she entered the solo spotlight, she was already planning to recede. Having started a family in the years following the Eurythmics split, she understood she'd entered a chapter in which releasing new music took a back seat to her life at home. In the years following its release, she'd move at a measured pace, resurfacing at irregular intervals, and almost as often as not, she'd do so as a vocal interpreter rather than a songwriter, releasing albums of covers between new collections of original material. When she hinted at retirement in 2014, it was just the latest step in a long journey away from pop stardom. And they've summed it up with Annie herself saying, with Eurythmics, I really devoted my life to the band. It came before everything else. Now that I am not in that position, what I do musically, although it's terribly important to me, is not the most important thing in my life. Professionally and personally, I've grown up. And in some ways, I feel like that's the story of the album. With all of that in mind, why do you think Diva has stood the test of time for you?
Oh, goodness. Where do I begin? Because it's all down to the songs on this album for me, aside from Annie herself, who I just think is a wonderful woman. It's being able to listen to this one from top to bottom on repeat. That's very rare, I think. And that voice that explores all different sounds, the diversity, the dynamics. You even, you know, we've touched on it. It's got the light and the shade. It's got the femininity, but also the originality of how she presents herself in those videos. Yeah, it's a career, it's a defining album. And on top of that, she's managed to transition away from you know, being something, a relationship, but also a double act with Dave Stewart so effectively and with such strength. Yeah, there's very little to fault here, I think. Yeah.
And finally, why is Diva your classic album, and why should people check it out if they haven't already?
Diva is my classic album because I'm all about longevity and timelessness. I think this one can still be heard today. How many years later? I can't do the maths. 25 years later, and we're still praising it. I would tell to anybody, I'd play it to my children. Annie Lennox has obviously been a huge influence on me, my writing, probably the way that I do vocals too. Just, you know, beyond just an artist that I like and respect, it's the whole hog here. So yeah, please do go and check it out if you haven't already. And also, it's, you know, it is the start. Beyond that, she goes and writes more hits and more beauty.
Well, Reva, thank you very much for joining me. I've had a great time chatting with you about this album, so thank you for coming. I know we've talked a lot about This Woman's Heart. Obviously, it came out last year. I know you'd released an EP back in May as well, kind of sort of tying in with that. Again, what else can we kind of expect? As you know, hopefully the world seems like it's starting to calm down a little bit. You know, what can we expect from you in the near future?
Well, I'm just sitting at home being inspired by Annie Lennox, another great artist. And I'm writing away. Obviously, there are a few live performances that have had to shuffle a bit, but we'll be announcing those soon. So, yeah, it's for me, it's a little bit, I've left a chapter behind in terms of, you know, now having released the two parts of a two-part album. And that felt really great for me to have finally put that out, because the two parts straddled the pandemic. So it felt right that I was bringing the second part out back in May. And so, yeah, it's all focused for the next releases, which, yeah, I think I'm pushing some boundaries creatively, which feels like the right time. So, yeah.
A really special album, an album that we can really kind of dig into and unpack. Thank you very much to Reva Taylor for joining me to chat about the fantastic album Diva by Annie Lennox. You know, absolutely phenomenal, phenomenal artist Annie Lennox. I think even to this day, she is absolutely one of my, if not my favourite female vocalist that there's ever been. I think she's absolutely fantastic. As for Reva, who has a hell of a voice herself, This Woman's Heart is out now. So that came out last year. There was also an EP, TWH.2, that came out earlier this year. So plenty of music from Reva. You know, I'm sure she's going to be excited to be getting herself on the road, all of this kind of stuff. So make sure you keep an eye out. I know a lot of the radio stations, she was talking about Lola Lennox getting a lot of love from Radio 2. I know that Reva does too, and I know that they're obviously big fans of hers. Absolutely check her out. She's absolutely one to watch. But that'll do it for another episode of My Classic Album. Thank you very much for joining me. One more, and then that's season 3 done. I'm going to take a little bit of a well-deserved break, and I'm going to come back in the new year. So there is one more episode, as I say, between now and then, and it's a biggie. 30 Years of Nevermind, with myself and Nathan Stevens Griffin. We're going to be chatting all about this phenomenal classic album, and that is coming up on the 24th of September. I will see you all then. Cheers!